This is the BBC.
This podcast is supported by advertising outside the UK.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile.
With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
It's Janae Desmond Harris, aka Dear Prudence, and I want you to tell me about all your problems. Each week on Slate's Dear Prudence podcast, I'm here to tackle your questions about relationships, sex, work, family, and beyond, all with the help of an expert guest. We'll help you navigate it all, whether you're a teen dealing with parents, an adult looking to spice up your sex life, or you just need some validation that you're not losing it. We're here to listen and to offer some guidance. Need help? Just ask Prudy. New episodes every Friday, wherever you get your podcasts.
BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
Hello, Jenny Murray welcoming you to Thursday's Woman's Hour on the 13th of August. Good morning. In today's programme, as protests against the re-election of President Alexander Lukashenko in Belarus continue, what's been the result of campaigning against him for the candidate who challenged him, Svetlana Tikhanovskaya? In the next, in our series about scars and the way we learn to live with them, Amy, who suffers severely from psoriasis. And how do you DJ during a lockdown? Might live streaming music, whilst nightlife is on pause, give women more opportunities to shine? Exam grades in chaos, teachers in despair, appeals set for meltdown. So read one newspaper headline this morning on the day young people across the country anxiously awaited the results of their A-levels. Of course, the results are not based on success or failure in exams taken this summer, but on teacher assessments, which have been altered by an Ofqual algorithm, or maybe on the mocks taken earlier this year. But what about those young people who will have no results because they don't go to school? They're home educated and have no teachers to make an assessment of the quality of their work. Alison Sauer is from the Centre for Personalised Learning. Jo Merritt is a researcher with the Centre for Social Mobility at Exeter University. Jo, what prompted the research into home educated pupils earlier this year?
Hi, so I was working with my professor, Anna Mountford-Zindars, and initially it was going to be a broader study about home education because there actually isn't a lot of research into home education. We don't know a great deal about it from a research point of view. And then when COVID hit, it seemed to be a really good example to see how differently home educators would adapt to the changes because they're obviously used to a very different experience of education. So that was interesting in itself. And then one of the outcomes of the research was obviously the tremendous detrimental impact of the exam cancellations on home educators because they often don't have a mock exam or teacher marked work. So there's no predicted grade. And so that's left a lot of parents now talking about exam poverty. And I think
What do you mean by exam poverty?
Well, I think a lot of people don't realise when you home educate, obviously that's your choice to do that. And for many, it's a very positive choice. But it does mean you pay for your own GCSEs. So a lot of parents have to pay hundreds of pounds per GCSE or per subject. And parents at the moment have faced not getting refunds from their exam centres because you organise sitting your own exam. So they've faced not getting a refund or partial refund from the exam centres. Then they've had to pay to change to a different exam centre where there's one available for their subject. And then they have to pay an admin fee to resit the exam. So one parent quoted having to pay out £1,000 to go and sit for her child to resit her maths exam, for example. And so lots of parents budget in advance for their GCSEs, especially if you've got more than one subject or more than one child. So the fact that they've not got refunds, had to pay out for the resits, has really had a massive financial impact.
Alison, what kind of support have you been able to offer parents and children in these unusual times?
Well, to be honest, Jenny, I mean, home education in and of itself has had to change massively because home educators go out normally and meet up normally. And it's kind of been the other way around. The home educators have been providing support forced to children at home because they've been closed. So from a support point of view, any support, which is merely this thing of the...
Alison, I'm really sorry. We've got a real problem with the line. We're losing 50% of what you're saying. Let's see if we can fix that, and I'll go back to Joe, and we'll try and come back to you. Joe, what sort of concerns have parents and children expressed to you about the effect this is now going to have on them and their future?
Yeah, I can actually just comment on what Alison was about to say, because a lot of the, in the results for the study, a lot of the parents actually reported setting up support groups for the families that were schooling at home during the school closures, because they were sharing a lot of knowledge and resources about how you can do your education at home during the school closures. So I can concur with what Alison said there. A lot of home educators reported supporting the schooled families at home. But with regards to the impact, lots of parents are concerned about the next stage in their education. So one example from one parent was that they said their child had been given a conditional place at their next step of education. They'd had interviews before the COVID pandemic had happened. They were assured that their child, based on her grades from the previous year, which was very close to getting in, and they were certain she would meet the criteria for this year. When she's gone back to them without a grade, they've said that unfortunately the provider didn't feel like it was fair to give her child a place over a schooled student who'd met the criteria and had a grade. And that seems to be, again, something that's come up in the parent responses, that felt that the college providers were, or alternative providers were, almost saving places for the school children with a grade. And because their children didn't have one, it left them at a massive disadvantage. And that's obviously having a knock-on effect, because once the child gets a bit older, and a lot of the parents were told their children could afford a year out because they were home educated. And I think that's probably not true, because the funding, the 16 to 19 funding, could be in jeopardy for a lot of parents, because their children are obviously going to be a year, possibly 2 years older, which means the 16 to 19 funding, if the child's already 18, is going to be lost.
Alison, I think we've got you back now. Fingers crossed for the line. What are you proposing to do to try and help these children who have no grades?
Well, it's a little bit difficult, because way back in April, both the Centre for Personalised Education, my charity, and Education Otherwise, who's the charity that support home educators exclusively, tried to meet with the DfE. The DfE refused to meet with us. Later on, my colleague EO met with Ofqual, made a lot of constructive proposals to find solutions, for example, socially distanced exams, online exams like the OU. Every single solution was rejected out of hand. We've just, the home educating cohort has just been completely dismissed from any support. Currently, they are saying, well, just take the exams in November. But as things stand, I can't see, you know, we've already got the year's delay because the children will not have their qualifications at the right time. There's massive discrimination. There's very little we can do except possibly consider a judicial review about this because of the horrific discrimination here.
Well, Alison Sauer and Joe Merritt, thank you very much. We did ask the Department for Education for their view, and they said, unfortunately, not all external candidates will be able to receive a grade if there is not sufficient evidence. They suggest, of course, that they can set their exams in the autumn. And then they say, we've asked all universities to be as flexible as possible in their admissions at this unprecedented time. Ofqual is working with the sector to consider how universities and further education colleges can make decisions about private candidates who do not receive a grade, such as reviewing other evidence of the applicant's achievements. If this is something that has happened to you, if you've been home educating, do let us know what situation you are in. You can send us an email, or of course you can send us a tweet. And Alison and Joe, thank you both very much indeed. Now, as you may have heard in the news, there have been demonstrations in Belarus in protest at the result of Sunday's elections, which saw President Alexander Lukashenko re-elected. More than 6,000 people are said to have been arrested, and leaders of the opposition have been jailed or driven out of the country. Among them is Svetlana Tikhanovskaya, who challenged the president in the election and has left for Lithuania after an apparent threat to her children. She was an unlikely opposition leader, saying she preferred to stay home, look after her children and fry cutlets rather than run for president. During the campaign, she was supported by two other women. One of them is Veronica Tsepkalo. We'll hear from her in a moment. But Sarah Rainsford first is the BBC's Moscow correspondent. And Sarah, I know you're not in Belarus. Why not?
Well, very frustratingly, I'm in Moscow because although I'm normally accredited to work in Belarus, this time the authorities haven't accredited me. So like many foreign journalists, we've been kept out of the country and having to watch from afar. And those who've gone into the country without accreditation, a huge number of them have ended up detained, some of them beaten, and all of them deported and banned from entering the country ever again.
Why did Svetlana stand?
Well, as you said, she never really saw herself as a presidential candidate. She's very much a reluctant, almost an accidental candidate. And the reason that she makes quite clear that she began this race for president was because of her husband. Now, Sergei Tikhanovsky is a very popular video blogger. He'd gone around the country for months making very critical videos about Alexander Lukashenko, talking to people about their problems, about poverty, their criticism of their president. He, in fact, called Alexander Lukashenko a cockroach. That became his pet word, if you like, for the leader. And when he tried to run for president, he ended up getting arrested. So Svetlana Tikhanovskaya stepped in. Although she's a complete political novice, this was certainly nothing she had planned to do. She called it, though, a mission she couldn't refuse. And once she'd started and once she saw the huge sort of groundswell of support for her, she said she just couldn't stop.
Now, two women supported her, Maria Kolesnikova and Veronica Tsepkalo. We'll hear from Veronica in a moment. Who are they? What's their background?
Well, this was the fascinating thing about this election race, because although Svetlana Tikhanovskaya is a complete novice, she was then supported by the campaign teams of two other candidates for president. Now, these were two men, one of whom, Viktor Babariko, was seen as a very strong contender, politically speaking, to Alexander Lukashenko. But he also was arrested shortly before registering or trying to register for the race. He was accused of money laundering. He's now in prison. Another contender, again seen as a serious contender, a former US ambassador, he ended up not getting registered and fleeing the country, he said, for his safety. That's Valeri Tsepkalo. So the campaign manager of the first candidate and the wife of the second candidate then joined forces with Svetlana Tikhanovskaya, and the three women became this very powerful symbol, travelling the country, holding these campaign rallies. Three women, often dressed in white, holding up a fist or a heart shape, which is what one of them would make to the crowds. And they really captured a kind of, I guess the frustration and the pent-up desire for change of many people in the country. And I think also worth bearing in mind, this in the context of a comment by Alexander Lukashenko, the president, who had said back in June that the constitution in Belarus was not suitable for a woman president because it gave the president too much power. And he said the society in Belarus wasn't ready to vote for a woman. And I think, you know, something of those crowds was people coming out and saying, actually, yes, we are.
Well, Sarah, thank you for the moment. I spoke, as I said, to Veronica earlier, and I asked her why she has left Belarus.
Well, actually, my family left Belarus several weeks ago because my husband, he was one of the candidates to the, and he was running for the presidential position. But in our country, if you have alternative opinion, you are not allowed to speak up. Therefore, he was at danger that he was going to put to the jail. At the same time, the authorities started the process of taking away of my kids. Well, actually, the first information which I received was from my school, from the school where my kids study. I received several phone calls that the authorities put the pressure on the teachers and asked them to write a letter saying, stating that I'm a bad mother, and the next step would be taking away my kids, putting them to the orphanage. So that's why my family, my husband, took the kids and they left Belarus several weeks ago. They went to Russia. I stayed in Belarus and I was campaigning with two beautiful ladies, with Svetlana Tikhanovska and with Maria Kolesnikova. We represented three different candidates. Two of them are already in the prison. So I stayed in Belarus for three more weeks, and then I decided to vote in the Russian Federation, in the embassy of Russian Federation, because I really missed my kids. I did not see my kids for several weeks. So I came to Moscow. I took my kids. We went to the embassy. I voted. And that evening, I returned back to Belarus.
How surprising, Veronica, is it that your children should have been used against you, that they threatened them to frighten you?
Well, actually, it sounds scary, but in our country, they use all methods to put the pressure on you. This is the reason why Svetlana took her kids outside of Belarus as well, because Svetlana, she took her kids to one of European Union country a week or 2 weeks before I did it. But in our country, yes, this is horrible things, and they use all possible and impossible methods to put pressure on you. And we had a history back in 2010. One of the presidential candidates, he was put in the prison together with his wife, and the authorities, Lukashenko regime, took away their son, and they couldn't get him back for 6 or even more months. So it's not like the first situation in Belarus. So I understand, as a citizen of Belarus, if they're collecting information on me, if they collect information on my kids, this is very serious. And the next step will be just, they will be trying taking away my kids. That's why I decided to isolate my kids, bring them outside of Belarus.
How, during the election campaigning, did the country respond to women standing against Lukashenko?
It was awesome. It was absolutely beautiful because we traveled. I mean, our trio, Svetlana, Maria, and myself, we traveled all around Belarus. We visited so many cities because we had a lot of meetings around Belarus. We visited large, medium, small cities. And I wish, I mean, if you follow up the news from Belarus, you definitely saw how many people came to our meetings, and people were very excited because we understand that people are ready for change. People don't want Lukashenko anymore because he has been in the power for the last 26 years. And people of Belarus are very tired of his attitude towards Belarusian people because, you know, like he humiliates us, he humiliates women, he insults women, he calls us different names publicly, openly. For example, as a last example, he called us pigs. I mean, he called women as pigs, and he said, like, we're giving a birth to the piglets. The constitution, Belarus constitution, is not for women. So we are used to this insult, but we don't want this insult and humiliation any longer. But in general, the people of Belarus were very, very supportive. They were really giving us a lot of energy, and they gave us the energy to move forward because it was quite a challenging and scary times for us, for our security.
Why did your attempt to win the election and the support that you seem to have had, why did it fail?
Well, actually, we didn't fail. I think Svetlana Tikhanovskaya, she won the election because the first time within 20 years, we saw the lines of huge lines of people, long lines of people standing and willing to vote. And we think that Svetlana Tikhanovskaya is the only illegitimate president of Belarus, because I'm sure that she got not less than 80% of the entire votes. And Lukashenko became illegitimate president. We ran several online initiatives just to make sure, to calculate how many people voted, to see the voting results. And in our platform, it calls the platform calls The Voice, more than 1,200,000 people registered. And according to the data from this platform, 80% of the people, they voted for Svetlana Tikhanovskaya. So basically, we think we did win. We think Svetlana is the only legitimate president, and Lukashenko lost in this presidential campaign. However, you know, they officially announced the results, and Lukashenko announced that he gained 80% of the voters, which is completely not true, and international community should not accept these results.
How is Svetlana now?
Svetlana, she is in Lithuania now. She had to leave the country because she spent 3 hours with people. We don't know who were these people, but I guess this is people from KGB or any other agency. I'm not sure because nobody knows this information. But she spent 3 hours with them. They had a conversation. Nobody knows what the conversation was about, but knowing that her husband is in a prison, they hold him as a hostage. This is my assumption. They probably showed her the pictures of her husband, maybe some videos, and also they were threatening her with her kids. This is my belief, because if you look at her video next day she published the video on the Facebook, in the social media, you see how threatened she was. You see the tears in her eyes, and her voice is shaking, and she is talking that she had to leave Belarus because she changed her mind. So I could tell that, because I know, I've been next to Svetlana for several weeks, I know her, that she's a very strong woman, and I'm sure that they put a lot of pressure on her, and they threatened her with her husband and the kids, and this was the reason why she had to leave. But I know that she's a very strong woman, she loves her family, she loves her husband, but at the same time, you understand, these people are very professional, they put a lot of negative pressure on you, they make you change your mind. It's really scary, taking into consideration that we live in the 21st century in the European country. So she's doing okay, but so far I did not have any contact with her. I called her, I sent her several messages, but I guess she's still under huge stress. That's why she's not responding. It will take some time for her to recover.
Veronica Tsapkalo and Sarah Rainsford, if I can come back to you just briefly, where does this all go now?
Well, it's a good question. I mean, the protests have continued for a fourth night. They're slightly smaller than they had been on three previous nights, but they've still faced this massive crackdown, this massive brutal response, really, by riot police and security forces. Thousands of people are in detention. There's big crowds outside police custody centres, people looking for the missing now across the country. But this is something on a scale and a scope that's never been seen in Belarus before. And I think whatever happens, clearly, Alexander Lukashenko, who's ruled for 26 years, and believes that he was supported, clearly that myth, if you like, has now been broken. Things can never be the same again in the country, whatever happens.
Sarah Rainsford, thank you very much for being with us this morning. Still to come in today's programme, the lockdown DJ. How do you play your music and perform when nightlife is no more? Might live streaming create an opportunity to make the industry more gender balanced? And the serial, the fourth episode of Bird in the Hand. Now, in recent weeks, we've been discussing scars on the body and the way we learn to live with them. Amy is from Kent. She's 34. She works in retail, is an artist and works for organisations supporting people with disfigurements and skin problems. She also has psoriasis. At 14, she started getting the most common form of the condition behind her knees and on her elbows. Then she began to develop guttate psoriasis all over her body and on her face. Anna Miller went to meet her at home.
When I knocked on the door today, you open the door, big smile, and you've got your makeup on. And I thought, it's a good day.
Yeah, definitely. It's been a few weeks now since I've had a flare-up, and my skin's looking really great at the moment. So I still have patches on other bits of my body. But no, yeah, today all clear and looking fresh and, yeah, happy.
Are you able to describe to me or even show me, let's call it a flare-up day?
Strangely, I've taken lots of photos of my skin during a major flare-up, and I have had those photos even printed, which sounds a bit crazy. But I think it's just to remind myself of what my skin can be.
Have you got any that I can have a look at?
So this was considered a really severe flare-up for me. The psoriasis, well, it started on patches on my forehead. First, it was just little kind of like small spot-sized dry patches, and they grew. So eventually each patch grew and kind of merged with each other, creating much larger patches of dry skin crossing my entire forehead. Both eyebrows were completely affected. Then it spread down the sides of my nose, around my mouth, until, yeah, it was pretty much dotted all over my face, neck and body.
And then you've got another one here.
So this photo is me with my makeup done. Obviously, I couldn't cover my skin at all. There's no way I could put any foundation on. It would just look dry and cakey, and it wouldn't be good for the psoriasis anyway. It would just probably cause the flare-up to get worse. So this is me on a good day, wearing one of my wigs, with my eye makeup fully done. And yeah, I felt glamorous this day. I was kind of, at this point, used to my psoriasis, but as you can see, it is covering my face still and my entire chest. So yeah.
Can you tell me what it feels like?
It felt like a burn, I guess, is how I would describe it. So it wasn't so much itchy. I constantly had this tingling, burning sensation on all of the patches of psoriasis that covered my face and, well, my entire body. And then it affects my scalp the most, actually, because scalp is probably the most common type of psoriasis you can get. So, yeah, my scalp's really badly affected with psoriasis. And during my flare up, I started to notice like a lot of hair loss. At one point, my hair was so fine, it was a few strands really that I could just hold together. What I ended up doing was buying wigs. Yeah, I just started collecting wigs to make myself feel better. And sometimes it would get bad enough that it would feel like an open wound, although it wouldn't necessarily appear to be bleeding, or obviously it would sometimes bleed, but even the feeling of my clothing touching my psoriasis would be completely unbearable. And I love all my clothes and I love fashion just as most girls do. I could only wear fleece-lined leggings and big baggy jumpers that were fleece-lined. I couldn't wear bras or knickers anymore, so I had to wear kind of like cycling shorts so that the elastic didn't cut into my skin. Having a shower, I couldn't use soap or shower gel. And at night time, I had to make sure that I was really moisturised. Throughout the day, I was having to get used to moisturising like on the hour. Getting off to sleep was really difficult. But it was quite miserable because it meant things like waking up the next day to a bed that would be covered in oil or grease or from my skin or blood or things like that. So,
do you remember the first time it happened?
It was over the course of 2 weeks. So initially, when I first got the Goutte psoriasis, I was misdiagnosed with chickenpox. I headed back to the doctors and he just really brushed it off like it was nothing. And I remember thinking, but it's affecting my face and you're not going to do anything about it. And I left and went back to work that day in tears, thinking it was just going to rapidly spread and get worse, which it did. So over the next few weeks, it got worse and worse to the point of I ended up staying at my mum's because I couldn't cope with how I looked. I'd stay at hers in the same room as her. So she set me up a little bed in her room.
That's quite a big move, isn't it? Going from an independent woman working, doing your own thing, to sleeping in the same bed as your mum to help you cope.
Yeah, it's definitely easy to look at people with psoriasis and or a skin condition and just think, oh, it is just a skin condition that they should be able to cope. But actually when it's you and it affects you, I remember my mum actually telling me a story about a friend of hers whose daughter had psoriasis and actually took her life because she couldn't cope looking in the mirror each day. When she told me originally, I remember thinking, that's crazy. Why would you take your life over psoriasis? But then when it happened to me, I kept thinking, I've never considered taking my own life, but I remember understanding her feelings. And what I couldn't cope with the most was that initial feeling in the morning of like remembering that how I now looked and having to accept it all over again. So I kind of would cope throughout the day, but that's why I stayed at my mum's, because I still went to work every day. That didn't change. I didn't have time off sick. I couldn't have time off sick just for a skin condition. But I couldn't face looking at myself. So in the morning, she was always ready, bless her, always at my side, waiting for me to like wake up. I just would burst into tears, and she would kind of comfort me and tell me I was beautiful and remind me that she would get me all the help that she could get me. You are aware of other people's reactions as well. How my feelings towards my psoriasis wasn't just how I felt, how my skin felt, even though it was unbearable and so uncomfortable. It was people, how people responded to me. Like, it was either negative and people looked at me like I was disgusting, or even made comments like at work, customers would say to me, "Oh, can I not be served by you? Because I think you've probably got something contagious."
What was your reaction to that?
I work in retail, so I'm selling like fashion. I just found myself initially just saying, "Yep, that's fine. I'll get someone else to serve you," and just kind of walking away from that situation and taking myself out of it, especially at the beginning when I was still quite upset about it. But to be honest, it didn't take me long to be able to say to people, "I'm just not contagious, I'm absolutely fine. So either you're served by me or you won't get served."
Do you think you could have coped with the situation better if it hadn't been on your face?
Yeah, 100%. If it wasn't on my face, I could have managed it and no one would have known. Everything else would have still been the same, like the discomfort, the treatments, everything would have been the same, but no one would have needed to know about it, and it could have been my own like private health condition. As soon as it affected my face, everyone had to know about it. Everyone could see it, couldn't do anything about it, couldn't cover it, couldn't stop it from progressing. So yeah, that was what was hardest for me.
Without being too intimate, did you literally get it everywhere?
Yeah, and I actually still do. I'm not embarrassed to say it, because I think a lot of people suffer in silence with that. The worst part of my psoriasis is down below, because it hurts to urinate, it hurts to go to the toilet. Underwear has become a problem all the time. Things like sanitary towels and stuff are impossible to wear just because they rub my psoriasis. And can also like affect things with my partner as well. I have to kind of say to him, like, at the moment I'm going through a bad patch, and I just, you know, it's open wounds all the time. It's constant bleeding, cracked skin.
I've been with you for the last hour and a little bit, and you know, the focus has been the face. And obviously now we've been together a while, you know, you feel more comfortable to talk to me, hopefully. But it's just the thing that actually I never even thought about it.
I didn't know if I would actually talk to you about it or not, because I guess it is very private. But I suppose actually talking about it's a good thing, because I don't think anyone talks about that. Even on social media, people that have psoriasis, you don't hear them talking about how it affects their genitalia or, you know.
We talked about your mum being supportive. Who else was supportive?
All of my friends and family were really supportive. I was single at the time, so I didn't expect to meet anyone with Guttate psoriasis. I just thought, yeah, until it either clears up, which I wasn't sure would happen. The doctor said it may never clear up. But yeah, I didn't expect to meet anyone during a flare-up until I met my partner. Yeah, because when I first met him, he had absolutely no questions about my skin at all. He didn't query it, didn't look at me any different, just approached me and said, "Wow, you're beautiful." And I think it was me that turned around and actually said, "Are you joking? Have you seen my face?"
He's looking at your face.
Yeah, I was just like, "Are you like actually looking at my face?" And he was just like, "There's nothing wrong with your face, is there?" And I said, "Yeah, look." And I really pointed them out. I was like, "Look at all these marks on my skin. Can you not see them?" And he was like, "Yeah, I can see them, but it's just your face. And you're beautiful." It was on our first date. We actually had people come over to our table in the restaurant and say, "Can I just say, like," I remember one lady came over to me and she went, "Can I just say, you look beautiful no matter what?" And again, I think that was another really nice experience. Like, I mean, the fact that she had to come over was a bit odd. I did think...
I was going to say, yeah. And I love that, like, "You look beautiful," and then it's that sentence at the end, "no matter what," and you're like, "Oh, thanks."
Yeah, it was a bit of an odd one. But I think it was... She
was trying.
She was trying to be kind. Yeah, so she thought she was doing a good thing. A lot of it is about what you choose to hear. I'd let things drag me down too easily. people started to contact me once I had my initial photo on social media and say, you're really inspirational and things like that. That was when I think I had to embrace it. And I thought, wow, like, I don't think I would ever have considered myself an inspiration to anyone. I was just plodding along through life, letting myself get down, which is easily done. We all do it. But probably thinking back now over silly things like men, and just realizing that actually you are what can make your life incredible. Opportunities started opening up. This is going to sound really strange, and I think people will think I'm a bit crazy for saying it, but I sometimes miss my flare-ups, like if I haven't had one in a while, because it reminded me that there are bigger things in life and that there are people that are worse off than you.
Amy was talking to Enna Miller, and if you want information or support about scars and skin conditions, you can find them on the Woman's Hour website. And of course, all the episodes in this series are there, or they're on BBC Sound. Now, DJs, disc jockeys, are not just people who spin records to which people will dance. They're performers, many of whom create their own music, put on a show in a nightclub, and are crucial to breaking new artists. But what do they do during lockdown when there is no nightlife? And how much more difficult is it for women who've had to fight for their place in an industry that's long been dominated by men? Well, I'm joined by Nayo Anya and DJ Flight, whose work is mainly in drum and bass. DJ Flight, that's a small example of the work that you do. Now, I know you founded something called EQ50, a project aiming to address gender balance in drum and bass, and that was in 2018. Why did you found it?
Simply for the fact that women haven't been supported enough or given big enough platforms within our subgenre of dance music for many years. I'm grateful for the level that I've been able to reach, but it's still very much a male-dominated industry. So a crew of us got together and just thought that we could use our profiles and platforms to try and encourage more women to get involved.
What effect has lockdown had on the project?
It actually hasn't had any negative effect. We've just launched a big mentorship program. It felt like the time was right, so we wanted to actually launch it last year, but we're all busy with commitments elsewhere. Just with people being furloughed from work in quarantine on lockdown, it felt like, and just watching the whole civil rights uprising both here and in the US and globally, it felt like it was the right time to kind of push this. Excuse me. People were focusing more on social issues. They had a bit more time to kind of take notice of what was going on.
And how much interest has there been in young women wanting to get into drum and bass?
We've had an amazing response, actually. We received maybe double the number of applications that we were hoping to. And just the responses that we've seen from men and women across our social media channels, via messages from our website, emails, etc. It's been a really positive response and proves that something like this was definitely needed. I think the fact that we're working with five established drum and bass labels definitely helps as well, because women can see that there will be official support for them should they want to try and get involved, whether that's producing or promoting or DJing, whatever it is.
Nayo, how have you been managing during lockdown?
So I went down a bit of the live streaming angle, where I luckily, before lockdown happened, well, about a year ago, I got a good sort of a unit, a DJing unit, which is what you would get industry standard in clubs, but sort of a lot smaller and easier to take around. And so that did mean that I could do quite a lot of DJing at home, which was incredibly lucky, because I think for a lot of people, as soon as you know, they weren't able to go into clubs, they didn't have anything to play on. So because I did have something that I could use, then I decided to do streaming whole DJ sets over the internet.
And how do people know where to find you?
Well, that's where it gets a little bit more complicated, I guess, because my major platform probably is Instagram in terms of social media and Facebook, but Instagram is probably where I have more of an engaged audience. And when it went online, playing over Instagram actually was the hardest thing, because when you're playing other people's songs, obviously everything's copyrighted. So as soon as a popular song is picked up by Instagram, it shuts down your live stream. And as soon as that happens after three or four times, it actually won't let you log back in. So there was quite a lot of difficulty around how to get around that. Some people started talking over the music, like with a microphone. But other people moved to Twitch, which is actually started out as a way that people could watch others playing video games. So again, some people switched over to that, but if you didn't already have an existing audience there, you're just kind of playing to no one. So it's been a bit of a juggling act.
Flight, I know you played a live stream from a club. What was that like? In a club, but no audience?
It actually felt amazing. It was just really nice being back in that environment with people who I love and really get on with, fellow DJs that I respect. The crew were all really cool. We kind of kept socially distanced. They cleaned down the equipment and had a little pause in between each set. Yeah, it was a great experience. I mean, personally, I've only done one live stream so far. I'm actually doing one later tonight that's just been announced as well. Yeah, I wasn't really in as much of a hurry as other people have been to do them during quarantine so far.
Why not?
I think because I realised that the coronavirus impact was going to last for quite a while. I can understand people wanting to keep their profiles at a certain level and keep busy. But, I mean, I'm quite grateful. I've got a day job as well. I work as a radio producer, so I didn't have as much of a financial worry as other people.
Naya, how has your income fared since lockdown?
I mean, it's kind of stayed the same. I've also been keeping busy. I do quite a lot of different things. So in terms of the DJing, that wasn't necessarily it was helpful. Obviously, money is always helpful, but it wasn't my main source of income. But yeah, going back into the world now, I've also played in a couple of clubs socially distanced, which has been really interesting. I've done a few live streams organised by bigger people, so they've been able to pay. So the fees have gone down. I think that's kind of to be expected. But also because I do run my own events, I think especially in Bristol, well, I don't know, especially in Bristol, could be anywhere. I've only been in Bristol because of the virus. But there's definitely been a kind of everyone banding in together. So it's kind of given the opportunity for more partnerships to open up that maybe wouldn't have had the opportunity to do this. So working with new types of promoters and new venues and being a bit more experimental, I guess, as well, in the way that we've been doing live streams and taking a few more chances, which has been interesting. So yeah, the fees have gone down, and I think there's an expectation that it will sort of slowly go back up. But again, it depends if the industry itself gets enough support, which at the moment is not looking that positive.
But Flight, how hopeful are you that you will achieve gender equality with the efforts that you've been making, despite the current restrictions?
I guess you have to stay optimistic at all times. It feels like there is movement now happening. I mean, with the labels we've got on board, they've all been really positive and happy to be involved. And after we announced, we did actually have quite a few producers hit us up directly offering their help. So, I mean, the plan always was to expand into different territories with this mentorship and do others. And just keep it rolling so that the mentees become mentors themselves in the future.
I was talking to DJ Flight and Nayo Anya. Lots of you were moved by what Amy had to say about her life with severe psoriasis. Emma Litterick sent a tweet. She said, "Brilliant to hear such an honest account of the constant debilitating effect of psoriasis. My sister suffered all her adult life with this condition. Its life-sapping consequences reduce the individual's capacity to live free of suffering. Thank you." Monica Markham added, "As a young girl, I once witnessed a woman being unceremoniously rushed out of the hair salon because she suffered from psoriasis and didn't disclose it before her appointment. It was horrendous, and I promised myself never to come to that salon again." And Bronwyn Jones said, "I empathise so much with Amy. Had psoriasis from 18 months, frequently hospitalised, all over. It's not just a skin condition. Tried everything. Avoiding gluten now. It's almost completely disappeared, miraculously, before my eyes." We also heard from a lot of you about homeschooling. Rachel Barkley in an email said, "Thank you for highlighting this issue on your programme this morning. I've been home educating for 10 years, our eldest two achieving A-levels studying from home. This year our youngest two were due to sit AS-levels, but due to COVID-19, these were cancelled. As our boys were studying independently, we were unable to submit for a predicted grade, so had to withdraw our entries. Greatly concerned about the future impact this would have on their A-levels. We felt forced into purchasing distance learning courses in case this happened next year. With twin boys, this has resulted in an outlay of almost £3,000, an expense families could do without at short notice, particularly this year. In one sense, we were fortunate that it wasn't their final A-levels. For many, this has resulted in crushed hopes and aspirations." And another parent, Nicola, emailed us, "I'm currently sitting outside my daughter's college having received her disastrous results by email. Parents are not being allowed to provide any support while the students talk to tutors about their options. I feel strongly that there's been no thought about those students who are not in the top percentage and would therefore receive the higher grades. My daughter is an average A-level student who was working so hard for the grades that she required for her chosen university. She had the chance to do better taken away from her. And there's no explanation so far as to how her grades have been arrived at. Her predicted grades seem to have been ignored, and for the moment she has no idea what to do next. All of my questions can't be answered online, so at the moment I feel helpless. And if my daughter retakes the exams, what does she do in the meantime? Currently, very frustrated. This is people's lives." Well, thank you for all your contributions to today's podcast. Tomorrow, we have another of our how-to guides for some of life's big questions. We'll explore the best way to handle conflict and tension. It might be at home, with friends and family, at work or in public. What's the best way to get your point across without letting your emotions overwhelm you? Join me tomorrow, usual time, 10:02. Until then, bye-bye.
Hello, it's me, Greg Jenner, the bloke from that funny history podcast, You're Dead to Me. Big news, we are back, once again combining the talents of comedians and expert historians as we explore stuff like ancient Egyptian pyramids, Genghis Khan, and 19th century vampire literature. Search for You're Dead to Me on the BBC Sounds app.
It's Janae Desmond-Harris, a.k.a. Dear Prudence, and I want you to tell me about all your problems. Each week on Slate's Dear Prudence podcast, I'm here to tackle your questions about relationships, sex, work, family, and beyond, all with the help of an expert guest. We'll help you navigate it all, whether you're a teen dealing with parents, an adult looking to spice up your sex life, or you just need some validation that you're not losing it. We're here to listen and to offer some guidance. Need help? Just ask Prudy. New episodes every Friday, wherever you get your podcasts.